This is day three of this November 2012 seven-day session. And we'll resume reading from the reading about the life of the Japanese Zen master Hakuin and his teachings. For this session, I've been focusing on his biography, but it contains so much of his teaching style, and I'll continue alternating in this book that I'm reading from, Wild Ivy, alternating between the translator's introduction, in which he sketches out in broad strokes the life of Hakuin, and then between that and then the main body of the book, which is Hakuin's own words, his autobiography. So we left off yesterday with Hakuin's great enlightenment experience. He had had a previous kensho at the sound of a temple bell, and in this one he had run afoul of an old woman who came out of her hut and swatted him with a broom and knocked him down into the mud, and that precipitated a deeper awakening than his first kensho. This was all while he was training under this hermit teacher, Shoju, this very severe teacher who he felt great affinity with. And he went back. We left off yesterday where he went back described the experience he'd had. He was in a state of rapture. And you'll remember that Shoju listened to this, and for this first time he warmly confirmed Hakuin's experience and said that now you must devote yourself to post-Satori training. Never let up. When I was at a Rinzai temple in Japan, I found that the monitor and timer were the same person for any given sitting. And next to that person's mat is the bell, what we call the inking bell in the Zendo, sat on a little stand. And the stand, this wooden stand, had some Japanese characters on it. And I asked at the time what they meant, and I was told they mean not yet. These two words encompass so much in the Rinzai or Linchi style of Zen practice and training. No matter what happens to us, no matter what we experience, no matter what realizations we have, we can go further. And we see this. Hakuin's life and his teaching, his life is the embodiment of this spirit of not yet. Can go further, further, further. And that's what his teacher Shoju emphasized when he was taking leave of him. I'm going to do a little sidebar here and read. And this is from his Hakuin's autobiography, so these are his words, where he talks about karma, basically. He says, if upon attaining Satori, if you can continue to devote yourself to your practice single-mindedly, extracting the poison fangs and talons of the Dharma cave, combing through texts of all kinds, Buddhist and non-Buddhist alike, accumulating a great store of Dharma wealth, whipping forward the wheel of the four universal vows, pledging yourself to benefit and save all sentient beings while striving every minute of your life to practice the great Dharma giving, and having nothing to do with fame or profit in any shape or form, you will then be a true and legitimate descendant of the Buddha patriarchs. And then he poses a question rhetorically. What about the saying that worldly fortune is a curse in the three periods? There's a footnote here. I forgot to check. Let's see if it adds anything, is informative. Yeah, it says here in the footnote that the great Dawi is, many of you have heard me read in Taisho from his works, a great Chinese master. Dawi explains to a lay student who is a minister of state how the worldly fortune most people seek easily becomes a curse that can extend over three lifetimes. And it goes on to say, worldly success in your present life easily makes you overlook your main spiritual concern, although it may allow you to create sufficient good karma so that you will be reborn into a position of wealth and power in your next life. In that next rebirth, you will have the means to enjoy life and do as you wish, but will accumulate unfavorable karma because you do not perform meritorious acts and deeply reflect on the course of your life. By your next rebirth, all the good karma you had accumulated is now used up, so when you die this time, you fall straight away into hell. The lesson to be drawn is that you should do everything in your power to take advantage of the rare opportunity of human birth and strive to attain liberation by seeing into your true nature. Now, Hakuin presents all this in his more colorful, vivid style. So again, the question he poses, what about the saying that worldly fortune is a curse in the three, in past, present, and future? Hakuin, great numbers of men and women seek advantageous rebirth in the next life, wanting to achieve Buddhahood, wanting to be born into the Pure Land. They strictly observe a life of purity, uphold the precepts to the letter, recite and copy sutras over and over, hold services for the Buddhas, extend charity to the monkhood, worshipping them with deep bows of reverence, make pilgrimages to religious centers throughout the land. And then he mentions some of them. People perform good works by the thousands, availing themselves of every secret art known to man. And yet as long as they don't attain the way by experiencing Kensho and hearing the sound of the single hand, they still aren't close to Buddhahood. They'll never even glimpse the Pure Land. What the world regards as good and beneficial is a bane in the three periods, past, present, and future. So what he's saying is that even all of the good works that religious people of every kind want to perform. For most religions, they perform good works in order to get to heaven. In Buddhism, in popular Buddhism, the idea is that if you do all these things that Hakuin just mentioned, that you can find a good rebirth and encounter the Dharma and go from there. He says, how about your present existence? By enduring endless hardships and performing countless good deeds, you may be assured of rebirth in your next existence as a prince, a gallant general, a powerful lord, perhaps the head of some distinguished family. So this means if you do enough of these good deeds and accumulate enough merit, even though you don't realize your true nature, you can reap this good karma in your next life. Then you will have riches and rank to use at will, power at your fingertips. You will no doubt exult in all that wealth and power. In this new existence, the events of your prior life will be totally forgotten. All those numberless acts of goodness performed in your former life will have vanished like dewdrops in the sun. You will gather an assortment of beautiful women for your wives, nubile concubines to embrace, servants and vassals at your beck and call in numbers you cannot even count. There will be fine purple skirts for wife Chang, stockings of precious gauze for concubine Li. The coffers of your own treasury not being equal to such extravagances, you will covet the property of others, engage in wholesale plunder, squeezing the people till they are dry, grinding the poor to powder. These acts of oppression will cause your subjects untold suffering. Piling evil deeds one on top of the other in such abundance, you will undoubtedly head straight for the evil destinations when you die. You will fall into one of the three evil paths, where an endless round of torment and suffering awaits you, or be born into one of the eight difficult realms. In the face of this, could anyone deny that worldly fortune is a curse in the three periods? So, of course, he's painting a bleak picture here of sort of the worst-case scenario. After getting off to a good start and devoting oneself to spiritual practices and dana, that is, giving, charity, generosity, and all these other things, devotional practices, that we may find ourselves with these kinds of riches in our next life, but then those riches can corrupt us and we can end up plummeting through these realms of unenlightened existence. I know that some people hearing this will pretty much just dismiss it as speculation, if not fanciful imaginary things about rebirth. I take it seriously. Hakuin's not the only one who laid out this scenario, and many of the great Zen masters and no doubt other Buddhist masters also issued this kind of warning. Of course, it doesn't mean certainly that riches can necessarily corrupt one, but it's so common, isn't it? It's so common that people who achieve stature through wealth or power then can't sustain it and become corrupted. I think of this law of causation and this the way that we can evolve and devolve, rising and sinking through the six realms of unenlightened existence. I think of this every time there is some new scandal, some powerful person or a rich person who gets into trouble. Often it's drugs and alcohol and marital affairs and other things. As we were going into Sesshin, we learned that General Petraeus confessed to having had an extramarital affair. It used to surprise me, these incidents, how these men, it's usually men who get into this trouble, how these men of great self-discipline, and intelligence and competence and power can then just take a nosedive at some point, no one having seen it coming. And then Hakuin, in his way, poses as if someone were asking the question, okay, well, that's for very successful lay people. He says, how can a priest avoid the evil caused by worldly fortune? And Hakuin says, to begin with, he must achieve Kensho, seeing anew his own nature, and attain the way. If he wants to see his nature, he must first hear the sound of the single hand. This became Hakuin's favorite koan in his old age. And even when one hears it, he must not be satisfied. Next, he must, quote, put a stop to all sounds. And then he must pass, one by one, all the other unsolvable, impassable koans. Even then, a final difficult barrier remains. And then he poses the words of a questioner. But after Kensho is attained and you have entered the path of enlightenment, surely there's no evil to obstruct you then. And then Hakuin, indeed there is. It exists if you create it. If you don't create it, it doesn't exist. This is a very potent statement. Even after awakening, that evil exists if you create it. There is no final resting spot where we are immune to the law of causation, to the consequences of our actions. The evil exists if you create it. If you don't create it, it doesn't exist. We are the architects of our fate. We create our karma. Karma is never to be confused with fate. Every moment we are revising our karma. It's not a fixed thing. It's a dynamic thing that we are changing, and we are purifying every time we cross our legs. Not just cross the legs. Every time we refrain from dwelling in thoughts, we are purifying our karma. And then, just to finish up with Hakuin's time with Shoju, it was only 8 months he was with him, but that's where he had that deep enlightenment experience. And then he takes leave of Shoju with deep gratitude, and then he sets off on his, what the book here refers to as his post-Satori practice. The chapter opens with a verse by Hakuin. Plenty of greens in my kitchen, but the chopping blade won't cut. stoking the temple stove with autumn leaves. The fire tongs are busy. Now the footnote is useful here, is illuminating. He said these are the first two lines of a four-line verse Hakuin composed for Bodhidharma's death day ceremony. And this is the whole thing. Plenty of greens in my kitchen, but the chopping blade won't cut. Stoking the temple stove with autumn leaves, the fire tongs are busy. A meager offering, true and authentic, I'm unable to present. The blue-eyed monk from India, that's Bodhidharma, is secretly heartbroken. And the translator here says that this is probably an expression of Hakuin's state of mind at this point in his training, when, having just left Shoju, he is about to proceed with post-Satori training. Perhaps the lines indicate Hakuin's sense of his unworthiness. Although he knows that he possesses a full store of attainment, he finds himself still unable to express it freely. And until he attains this freedom and full awakening, he will be unable to truly requite the immense debt of gratitude he owes the founder of the Zen tradition, Bodhidharma. So look at the contrast between this state of humility on Hakuin's part now, after his deep awakening, as compared to his state of mind after that first Kensho, where he was swaggering around and with the stink, what we call the stink of enlightenment. Now his realization of the illusory nature of self is complete. No pride left, but no pride, but still work to be done. He spends time nursing his earlier teacher, Sokudo, who we mentioned yesterday. That was the teacher he had for a few years when he was in his late teens after becoming ordained. And he got word that there was no one to look after him. He was dying. There was no one to look after him. So he went back and took care of him. He writes here, even as I nursed him, I complied faithfully with the injunction Shoju had given me when we parted at the foot of the mountains. Never for a moment was I remiss. Regularly and without fail, I sat for 8 incense sticks of zazen each night. Sat for 8 incense sticks of zazen each night. There's a footnote here that just says that we don't know how long those incense sticks burned, but that that these days a typical length of time would be 30 minutes each. So 4 hours at least. I'm sure they're at least 30 minutes in Hakuin's time. 4 hours of zazen each night after his satori. And then he was on pilgrimage. He says here, I experienced satoris both great and small in numbers I could not even count. Unfortunately, shortly after that, the heart fire, unbeknownst to me, began to rush upward, oppressing my lungs and parching them of their essential fluids. Before I knew it, I had developed an incurable disorder of the heart. And a footnote says that this illness of Hakuin's has been described by modern writers as tuberculosis, pleurisy, nervous collapse, or a combination of all three. I began moping around in a dark, melancholy state. I was always nervous and afraid, weak and timid in mind and body. The skin under my arms was constantly wet with perspiration. I found it impossible to concentrate on what I was doing. I sought out dark places where I could go to be alone and just sat there motionless like a dead man. Neither acupuncture, moksha treatment, nor medical potions brought me any relief. Here I think we can appreciate that anyone, even a deeply enlightened person, when you're sick, you're not in your right mind. You can't be. You can't be seriously ill in your body and be of bright cheer in the mind when it's really a serious illness. He says, I was ashamed to return and show my face at Shoju's in my present state. I wanted to comb the country and search for a wise teacher who might be able to offer some cure for my condition. But I couldn't leave the master's sick bed even for a short time. I tried praying to Buddhas, but that didn't do any good either. And then he came upon, in his travels, he came upon a master by the name of Egoku. And Egoku told him, attempting to cure Zen sickness only makes it worse. Find the quietest, most secluded spot you can. Settle down there and do Zazen with the intention of withering away together with the mountain plants and trees. You mustn't spend the rest of your life running all over the country looking for someone to help you. But he didn't take Egoku's advice, and he went off and had some more adventures. I'll mention some of them here. He found a monk who he thought was superior in his aspiration, and they hooked up and began sitting a lot together. He said, on one occasion, the two of us engaged in a private practice session. We pledged to continue it for 7 days and nights. No sleep. No lying down. We cut a 3-foot section of bamboo and fashioned it into a makeshift staff or stick. We sat facing each other with the stick placed on the ground between us. We agreed that if one of us saw the other's eyelids drop, even for a split second, he would grab the staff and crack him with it between the eyes. Another thing not recommended during sesshin. We went through Roshi Kaplan went through a period where he would invite 3 or 4 people who, on the last night of sesshin, he would invite 3 or 4 people who he felt were closest to breaking through their koan to go up and spend a few hours in the 5AP library and just continue there with being struck with a stick a lot of those hours, sort of a special treatment. All right, I'll finish this up. And the night that I got through Mu, was the last night of sesshin, Roshi said to me, okay, good. Now, if you want to go to the top of your class, we can see how you do up in the library. So I went up there with 2 or 3 others, and, I didn't get to the top of my class, but I didn't feel I needed to at the time. I was pretty happy. But the remarkable thing was that I for the first time in being struck with a stick, and they had always hit me a lot, but now all I felt was gratitude. I had always, coming out of sesshin, I had felt gratitude to the monitors for all their labors. But in this one night, it was the whole, whatever it was, 3 hours there of being struck up in the library. It just was wonderful, wonderful. This is what's possible if we can receive the stick without critical thoughts, without fear. For 7 days we sat ramrod straight, teeth clenched tightly in total silence. Not so much as an eyelash quivered. Right through to the end of the seventh night, neither one of us had occasion to reach for that cudgel. And then he found his way to another temple. The abbot of the temple wished to have me stay on at the temple as his successor. But Hakuin wouldn't have it. And then he describes another wild experience where he got caught in a violent rainstorm. He found himself fallen into the mud. He ended up, seemed to be another awakening experience. When I returned to my senses, I began clapping my hands together with delight and emitting great whoops of laughter. And so forth, just another of his many awakening experiences. And then he takes a little side trip here in his autobiography to warn about what is called silent illumination, where you, it's a more quiet, quietistic kind of practice. It's very similar to Shikantaza, but I think I've come to understand that it's not quite the same. I had a conversation on the phone with a Zen teacher, one of my buddies from another lineage, who suggested that silent illumination and Shikantaza are not quite the same. I had always sort of equated them, that according to him, silent illumination is a quieter, less active kind of practice than Shikantaza, and Shikantaza being, you can't call it active and you can't call it passive. It's beyond such categories. I don't know. I'm still considering that difference. The truth is, I don't know much what so-called silent illumination is. It's more of a Chinese thing. Shikantaza, as you can tell from the word, is more of a Japanese thing. But Hakuin really had it in for what he calls unborn Zen. This is Zen that was propagated by a Japanese Zen master, Bankei. I also have read from his teachings, and he also seems to have had a great enlightenment, and he then always taught in terms of using this word unborn, the unborn Buddha mind. Hakuin seems to have taken issue with him because he emphasizes, as some of you may remember from the Teishos, he emphasizes that there's nothing we need to become. We are already, we are endowed with this unborn, enlightened Buddha mind if we could just drop our thoughts. But Hakuin felt to say that easily lends itself to misunderstanding and can cause monks to just settle into a kind of complacency. When I was at Bukokuji, Tongan Roshi also had a swipe at this kind of idea, and the tendency, especially in the Soto school, for monks to say, well, we're already fully enlightened from the very beginning, so what is there to attain? It's what's called Buji Zen. Buji Zen means the this appears in the three pillars. This is the idea that since we have always been enlightened, there's nothing to attain, and so you just, you know, while away time in the Zendo, just being free of thoughts or whatever. It's a real snare to think that effort is not required, and especially to Hakuin. So here's what he said. At this one temple he stopped in, sad to say, they were all pursuing the dry and lifeless methods of the unborn Zen that had taken such a hold on people's minds in recent times. Aside from their morning and midday meals, on which they all did an admirable job, both old monks and young monks alike spent their days seated like lumps in long, lifeless ranks, nodding away like oarsmen. At night they waited with pricked ears, listening for the bell to announce the end of the sitting period. Then they lined up their pillows in long rows and laid themselves down to sleep. As they did this, they chanted loudly back and forth, "Great happiness and peace, great happiness and peace." It's hard to know how much of this is Hakuin's embellishments. There's another one here where he really gives it to them. I'll have to. He says, for the past 100 years, ever since the passing of national master Gudo, advocates of blind, withered up, silent illumination Zen have appeared within the Rinzai, Soto, and Obaku schools. In spots all over the country, they band together, flicking their fingers contemptuously, pishing and pooing. I don't know what that, it's not spelled the way it sounds. And then he's imitating them. Great Satori, 18 times. Small Satoris, beyond count. Pa, it's ridiculous. Excuse me. This reference to 18 Satoris and countless smaller ones is referring to a great master, a predecessor of Hakuin's, who they say had all these great enlightenment experiences. Pa, it's ridiculous. If you're enlightened, you're enlightened. If you're not, you're not. For a human being, the severing of the life root that frees you from the clutches of birth and death is the single great matter. How can you count the number of times it happens, as if it were a case of diarrhea? Dawei, I guess this was Dawei, that they're dismissing. His great awakenings. Dawei made statements like that because he was ignorant of the supreme, sublime Zen that is to be found at the highest reaches of attainment. Supreme Zen at the highest reaches does not belong to a dimension that human understanding of any kind can grasp or perceive. It is a matter of simply being Buddhas, the way we are right now. Covered bowls of plain, unvarnished wood. It's the state of great happiness and peace, the great liberation. Put a stop to all the chasing and hankering in your mind. This is still Hakuin presenting their what he considers outrageous point of view. Do not interfere or poke around after anything whatever. That mind-free state detached from all thought is the complete and ultimate attainment. And then Hakuin. Here we go. These people, true to their words, do not do a single thing. They engage in no act of religious practice. They don't develop a shred of wisdom. They just waste their lives dozing idly away like comatose badgers. Useless to their contemporaries while they live, completely forgotten after they die. They aren't capable of leaving behind even a syllable of their own to repay the profound debt they owe to the Buddha patriarchs. Maintaining, come hell or high water, we are Buddhas just as we are, plain, unvarnished bowls, they proceed to consume heaping piles of rice day after day. Wait for it. They then disburden themselves of steaming loads of horse flop, great copious pillows of the stuff. That is the sum total of their achievements. Okay. I think what we can take from that is, but seriously, what we can take from that is self-examination. What are we doing here? How are we using our time, especially in Zacin? We come here, most people can only come to one or two, maybe three Zacins a year. We don't know how much longer we'll be able to. What are we doing? This drowsiness, the nodding off in the Zendo, especially, what can we accomplish if we're nodding off? The trouble is, a drowsiness is something that can be so pernicious. It can just creep in over the mind without our even knowing it. Many people have experienced this, and we can just find ourselves, we just can slip into it and just spend gobs of time just lost in the states of oblivion, unconsciousness. This is why I don't ever want to not offer the stick. The stick is a way. If you find that you're exasperated because you keep slipping back into states of drowsiness, and you feel utterly inadequate in what you're doing, well, the stick can make a difference. It can. It's not only to help wake one up. It's also to break up the thoughts that get lodged in the mind, or these trains of thought that we just go round and around and around, these sticky thoughts that we can't seem to pull free of. The stick can just shatter them. Sometimes when I know that people are going through rough time in Zacin, the thought comes to my mind of laying off them with a stick, not giving them a break for the stick, but I think it's the wrong way to go. Is people get bogged down because of the thoughts in their mind, and the stick is a way to free them of those thoughts. I'm returning now to the introduction, or the translator's introduction, that just describes in broader terms what Hakuin went through. It became clear to Hakuin that his attainment was still incomplete. Still. He had no doubts about the depth of his enlightenment. He was sure that his grasp of koans and Zen writings was sharp and clear, yet he found it impossible to sustain the tranquility he experienced in the quietness of the Zendo when he returned to the tumult of everyday life. I feel like a physician who possesses a wonderful knowledge of medicine but has no effective means of curing an actual sickness, he lamented. How can I possibly hope to help rid other sentient beings of their afflictions as long as I still suffer from illness myself? With renewed determination, he now grasped the whip in hand and spurred the dead ox forward once again. The focus of his post-Satori training was directed henceforth to achieving the total integration of the two aspects of his life, the quiet and the active. So this also points to the difficulty of integrating what we have experienced into our daily life. Certainly, awakening, this is the challenge after some, even a small degree of awakening. How do we bring into harmony what we've seen, that is the insight? How do we bring that into harmony, or bring our daily actions, our conduct, our work, our relationships, how do we bring that into harmony with what we have seen? Roshi Kaplow used to mention this at every introductory workshop. He would say there's the awakening, but then there is this lag where one continues to be vulnerable to the habit forces that brought us to practice in the first place. Whatever it is, anger, depression, any of the habit, every person can look at their own habit forces, the stubborn tendencies that we keep getting blindsided by. Anyone can look at those. How to work on those out of this state of greater insight. But it's also, even short of even an initial insight, we see this challenge right after Sesshin, where we can reach these heights of clarity and serenity, even joy during Sesshin, and then afterward we go through this re-entry process where we're confronted with all of the difficult things that we had faced, struggled with before Sesshin. And this is, for many people, one of the hardest parts of the Sesshin experience is afterward. And then Hakuin fell into this Zen, we already referred to it, the sickness, this TB, pleurisy, nervous collapse, or whatever. And then he found his way to a supposed hermit Hakuyu. This is not the other one, but this is one who was reputed to have special curing powers and ways that could help Hakuin cure himself of sickness. And this became a big part of his teaching. We're not going to get into it in this session because it will take us far afield into all kinds of medical health issues, about very much a lot of Taoist kind of things. But this is still in his late 20s, where he had to go through this, what he calls Zen sickness. I never quite understood why it's called Zen sickness. It's not like his Satori caused the sickness, although it can happen after awakening that some underlying latent vulnerability in one's health can be exposed, and one can go through some medical issues. That certainly happened to Hakuin. So that was around age 25. And then he went and lived in a hut on a mountain, Mount Iwataki, for well over a year, pushing himself mercilessly, fasting and going without sleep for days at a time, determined not to let up in his efforts until he achieved a further breakthrough, even if it cost him his life. During this period, he writes, a man of old has said that the practice of Zen requires three essentials: a great root of faith, a feeling of great doubt or questioning, and a great burning aspiration. Lack any one of these, and you are like a three-legged cauldron with one leg broken off. He says, the most important of the three is the great burning aspiration. You may possess an abundance of deep-rooted faith and a great doubt as well, but if the burning aspiration is not present, the great and marvelous power for healing others will not develop, and you will be incapable of curing the besetting illnesses of mankind and liberating sentient beings. What are those besetting illnesses? Ignorance, the afflicting passions, birth and death, the very roots of karma. What is a great burning aspiration? The intense arousing of the mind in fearless determination to move forward to deliverance, liberation. So it is said, and he quotes someone, doesn't say, attainment of Buddhahood comes in one instant of thought for sentient beings who are fearless and intrepid. For those who are indolent and slothful, the passage to nirvana can take three long kalpas. Now, I know from past experience that some of you hearing this are shriveling with a feeling of inadequacy, feeling anything but this kind of power and faith and great aspiration. Okay, so that's the way it is for all of us up to a certain point, but it's by doing this practice that we develop not just faith, that always, yes, faith is, always comes from experience. The more we sit, the deeper our faith becomes. But not just faith, but the aspiration itself, the aspiration grows if we continue it. The practice. It's like karma. It's not. There's nothing static. This is the Dharma. Nothing is static. Nothing is fixed. We're not stuck with what we imagine to be ourself, our miserable, inadequate self who can't seem to get anywhere. We're not stuck with that. We're reshaping ourselves all the time. We're reforming ourselves. We are purifying the mind. We are shedding. We are sloughing off the obstructions. Doesn't happen as fast as we'd like. But it happens if we just persist. It will happen and it will continue to happen. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.